children from their parents shocked the country. My colleague, Hamid Ali Aziz, has found that in Trump's second term, family separations are back. I'm Mike Wilborough. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times at 6:30 on Radio Catskill, right after the local edition.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for joining me. Tonight, we are live with Philip Pantuso of the Times Union to get the latest news, which is a regular thing we tend to do on Thursdays. And everything will be fine as long as Philip is with us live right now. Philip, welcome back to the local edition.
I'm here. Oh, then good to be with you.
Everything's fine then. That's great. Thank you for being here. So, let's start off. The first thing I want to talk about is, West Nile virus has been detected in the area again.
Yeah, this is a story I feel like we write almost every year, but we do it sort of as a public health service, basically. Orange County public health officials this week confirmed that mosquitoes that they had collected from traps as part of their ongoing mosquito surveillance efforts had tested positive for West Nile virus. These were found in the Greenwood Lake area, and this marked the first time that the disease, which is, you know, mosquitoes are the vector for it, was detected in the Hudson Valley or Greater Capital Region. So basically the entire Times Union coverage area.
Wow. So what are officials saying about this instance?
Basically, they're not really sounding the alarm because, again, this is something that is fairly common. You know, they'll find mosquitoes with West Nile almost every year, especially in recent years when we've had some hotter and wetter summers, which are obviously what mosquitoes thrive on. It's obviously much more concerning if humans start getting infected with the virus. And so at this point, they're basically urging the regular suite of precautions, which are to wear insect repellent when going outdoors, to dump standing water, which is a common breeding ground for mosquitoes, and to kind of educate yourself on what the symptoms are. Apparently, and this is something I did not know until editing this story, some 20% of people who contract West Nile virus actually don't exhibit symptoms. But of course, the common symptoms that people do have when they do get them is body aches, nausea, and those will usually come on within a couple of days of being bitten.
Wow. And is this potentially something that even if they aren't exhibiting symptoms, they can pass on to somebody else?
Well, if you're symptomatic, it's obviously much easier to spread. The main way that it spreads certainly is by mosquitoes. And so that's why county health officials are stressing all of these measures that try to prevent you from contracting it from mosquitoes in the first place.
Right. And that's from Orange County public health officials. And the only thing I'll add is, because this is new information to me in a story that, like, we have mostly heard before, is neglect, you know, talking about getting rid of standing water, which is a breeding ground for the mosquitoes, that neglected swimming pools are among the biggest risks and can produce up to 1 million new mosquitoes in a season if not properly tended. So if that's not incentive to properly tend your pool, I don't know what is.
A grim visual, right? Right. I should also note, according to federal health data, at least 2 people have been infected in New York with West Nile so far this year. Those 2 infections were in Western New York, so far from this area of the state, but it has been active in the state this year.
Okay, you'll be keeping an eye on that. And something that you've been keeping an eye on and that we've been keeping an eye on is just the impacts of federal funding cuts on our region. But this story, just from the briefs, I'm not entirely sure if this one is part of the larger efforts, the Office of Government Efficiency, the DOGE efforts to make cuts. But this is about the proposal to downsize a military treatment facility, an Army community hospital in West Point.
Yeah, so we're not entirely sure if this is from DOGE. Certainly, it's fair to say that this is part of the Trump administration's overall move to cut costs and shrink the size of the federal government. Part of the reason we do not know all of the details of this proposal, including exactly where it's coming from, is because it has not yet been made public. But this is a proposal from the Defense Health Agency, which is part of the Department of Defense. What the Defense Health Agency does is it manages military healthcare systems to downsize 17 military treatment facilities across the United States. And these cuts are greater or larger depending on the facility. As you noted, one of them, I believe the only one in New York, is Keller Army Community Hospital at West Point. And really, all the details we have from this are from Congressman Pat Ryan, of course, a West Point graduate who represents the military academy as part of the 18th Congressional District. He shared details about this in a press release last week that kind of raised initial alarms about this proposal, which he said would essentially turn what's a sort of full suite hospital right now into an urgent care center. And then he gave us a few more details to our reporter earlier this week as we put this story together. But what they were told in a video conference call by staff from the Defense Health Agency is that agency wants to downsize and to save money amid what it called a decreased demand for services.
Okay, and so that's the agency is saying there's a decreased demand for services. Do we know if that's the case, at least in West Point?
It's hard to say. We don't have super robust patient data for West Point since it's a military hospital. The most recent data that we have was that it serves about 7,000 active duty members per year and about 400 family members of both active duty and retired military per year. So that's, you know, my math is right, more than 11,000 patients per year. And it currently has 288 hospital beds and provides a range of services, including family and internal medicine, general surgery, orthopedic surgery, physical therapy, dermatology, ophthalmology, 24/7 inpatient unit, and other medical services. The hospital is also used for military medical training exercises, of course, as it's the hospital on the campus of the premier Army academy in the country.
So those who are enrolled there who are going into specialized medical aspects of military service, that's where they can get some experience.
Yeah. And what the Defense Health Agency has said, you know, without really providing too many numbers to back this up, is that there has been a lower demand on those services. They want to sort of quote unquote downsize to try to save money. They said, according to Congressman Ryan, that patients who need more intensive treatment, including inpatient care, can seek that at private facilities offsite.
And, your article makes note here, the Times Union article makes note of the fact that this is following the closure of Castle Point back in February, which is something I just want you to mention for the listener, because the listener might not be aware, but either I have forgotten or I wasn't aware that Castle Point actually did end up closing.
Well, Castle Point, the whole facility is not closed.
Okay.
But what happened in February was The VA closed a acute inpatient care unit there, which treats veterans with substance use disorders. That was a 20-bed unit that was shut down, we were told, temporarily on February 1st. An executive assistant to the director of the Hudson Valley VA system told us back then that the closure would last 120 days, quote, as part of an effort to reevaluate staffing needs. According to that timeline, that means the unit would have reopened on June 1. It's now, checks watch, August 7th, and the unit has not reopened. We reached out to that same spokesperson this week. They said they are in the process of onboarding staff and will be reopening in the coming months. But he did not provide a more specific timeline when we asked.
Okay, and I just want to reiterate this because I gravely misread this and misspoke on air. I don't want to be spreading any kind of false information. So the Castle Point did not close, but there was an inpatient care unit of about 20 beds that did close. They said it would be a temporary closure, and so far it hasn't been temporary.
Yeah, and one thing that's worth saying here, I think, I've done a lot of reporting on healthcare consolidation in particularly in rural regions over the years. And this is a kind of common playbook where you have large hospital systems that seek to consolidate services, quote unquote, which often means what they'll say they're doing is that either the needs aren't there or they can provide more efficiency or efficiently serve patients and up the standard of care by, quote unquote, consolidating services. But usually it's a way to, the services that are being consolidated are the most expensive ones. And there have been innumerable studies that show that when this happens, and it does happen all across America, costs go up for patients and the quality of care goes down. That's almost a universal outcome. And so what I think is unique about what's happening at Keller and at Castle Point is that situation I just described is something that happens in private hospitals, you know, where there's a lot of sort of private equity and other private investment and more of a, you know, overt profit motive. You know, one thing we've seen throughout this Trump administration is some of that kind of thinking kind of, frankly, take over the federal government. And, you know, that's exactly, I think, why this is happening. It's certainly the approach that leads to these kinds of decisions. So I should also note that the push against this proposal, this most recent one from the Defense Health Agency, has been bipartisan. Two Republican U.S. senators, Roger Marshall of Kansas and Josh Hawley of Missouri, have also voiced concerns about plans to downsize facilities in their states after they learned of the proposal.
And just because of the division that this is coming under, like, would those facilities be military related too?
Yeah. So these are military hospitals in Kansas and in Missouri.
Okay, and before we wrap on this story, anything else, from Congressman Ryan's office?
That's basically it. You know, he spoke to us for the story, and then he wrote a letter to the director of the Defense Health Agency, basically saying this plan is ill considered, and that forcing West Point patients to seek inpatient care off site is, quote, an unacceptable insult to those you are sworn to serve.
This is a local edition. We're talking to Phil Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. We're going to pause for a moment. We have more news to come, including information about a former Beacon City police officer facing a ruling from a grand jury related to a shooting last month. That story and more when we come back. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar, host of Farming Country. This week, Jamie Case heads down to the Wallkill River to learn how flooding is changing community gardens.
Some people's plots just look really nicely watered and other ones were devastated.
Plus, flowers are in full bloom in Jeffersonville. We stop by Momo Global Flowers to learn about the Japanese art known as ikebana. Join me this week on Farm and Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
The Trump administration has said that they do not separate families. But what I found is that there have been at least 9 families that have refused to be deported to their home countries. It's at that point that the government is separating these families.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
And that's coming up in just less than 15 minutes. Right now, it is a local edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'm talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. We're live tonight. And Philip, the next story that we got is about a Dutchess County grand jury handing up an indictment to a former Beacon City police officer in conjunction with a shooting last month. What did the grand jury have to say?
Yeah, so this is, I can't remember if I talked about this on the show when it happened or not, but kind of a shocking story. Retired Beacon City police officer fatally shot his roommate and then, called 911 himself to report what he had done. We have a lot of questions about what exactly led to this. Including how this police officer ended up in this situation. He retired in 2021 and had recently been living in North Carolina, according to neighbors on Rombaut Avenue where this happened. He had only moved back about 2 months ago. So he was arrested that night and initially charged by state police with first-degree murder and two criminal possession of a firearm charges. The grand jury indictment, which was handed up this week, charges him with just second-degree murder, which that's a pretty big difference because, of course, first-degree murder is about the most serious charge you can get, and it requires some sort of premeditation, right? And so I think the fact that that got knocked down to second-degree after the grand jury considered the evidence that was put forth may tell us, it's a clue at least into what might have happened that night and whether it was a sort of spur of the moment reactionary thing or something that, had more forethought, which is what would have been required to substantiate the first degree murder charge. Regardless, the grand jury did hand up the indictment charging him with second degree murder, and he was arraigned this week. He pleaded not guilty. We also learned that he was using a 9mm semi-automatic Glock and that he shot the roommate several times. It wasn't just like the gun went off or something. He's at Dutchess County Jail now, and he will be back in court toward the end of next month.
The change in the charge from first degree murder to second degree murder. I mean, you explained that change happened, but do we know anything about why that was changed? I mean, in charges are usually brought in part because of what officials and law enforcement are like, what can we actually, basically make stick? Like what is the actual crime and what is the most convictable? Is that part of what's at play here? Do we know anything about why there was a change?
We do not. We're assiduously digging away at this we have a lot of unanswered questions here. That's one. The ones I mentioned earlier are others. You're right to say that, usually when a grand jury hands up indictment, there aren't new charges. So prosecutors tend to seek, the highest level of charge that they feel confident they can get a jury to convict the defendant on. But without really knowing what that evidence is, of course, it's a sealed grand jury. The charges are sealed right now. There's you know, there's very little we can say about why the charge was knocked down.
And you say that his next court appearance is scheduled for September 24th. Is there much more that we're going to learn then, do you think?
We don't exactly know what will be happening at that court appearance. We will certainly be there. So if there is more to learn, you'll hear about it. We're here on the local edition, certainly.
Absolutely. Well, and now, finally, before we go, we got one more story. This is a sad passing of somebody who did a lot in the local arts community. What can you tell us?
Yeah. So this was the co-founder of the Woodstock Film Festival and the longtime director of the Hudson Valley Film Commission, Laurent Reto. I think I'm saying that right. He died last weekend at age 63 following a brief but by all accounts pretty intense battle with pancreatic cancer. And he is more responsible than really anybody for the big increase in film and TV production in the Hudson Valley and Catskills in the last decade or so. He, you know, as I mentioned, he co-founded the Woodstock Film Festival, which has become, you know, a pretty, you know, it's a small but mighty film festival. It usually gets several bigger premieres, and they'll have A-list stars come through. And he, as the director of the Hudson Valley Film Commission, which he co-founded in the early 2000s, he has been a big, big advocate for getting film production crews to base their shoots in the Hudson Valley. You know, we will cover that as a kind of growing industry. He's somebody who we end up talking to basically all the time. Essentially, what he does there is he's an advocate on behalf of the industry to like producers and filmmakers. And then he's also a sort of logistics coordinator. So he basically sets them up with everything that they need in order to shoot a film or an episode or episodes of television in the area from sort of down list cast, extras, crew, supports on set, like, you know, catering, grips, engineers, things like that. Back in 2022, which is the latest numbers we have, there may be more recent reports, the Hudson Valley Film Commission tracked $67 million in direct local spending from productions. And, you know, that had more than doubled what was spent just in 2018. I think those had stagnated or maybe even gone back a little bit in the last year or two, really as a result of the, you know, the Hollywood strikes that put a halt on film production everywhere.
Right.
But what the Film Commission estimated is that its overall economic impact in local spending has been something like $500 million since 2000.
Wow. Can you tell folks if there's any shows that people have seen that were filmed in the Hudson Valley, shows or movies that they'd be familiar with because of his work?
Yeah, I mean, probably the most famous one, at least recently, is Severance, that shot widely throughout throughout the Hudson Valley, especially Ulster County. I know this much is true. A Quiet Place, The Undoing. There have been so many others, too. If you just Google Hudson Valley movies, basically any thing that's been shot up here in the last two decades or so has the Hudson Valley Film Commission to thank in some capacity.
And I think we've reported on here before about Eng's Chinese Restaurant in Kingston, you know, being featured in Severance. So it's interesting to hear that he was part of this. But with this passing, I mean, he did so much to make this happen, to bring more film production to the Hudson Valley. Will his passing negatively impact the amount that's happening, or has it been set up in a way where that might actually continue now into the future?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it sort of remains to be seen. So his children have been involved in the Hudson Valley Film Commission. He co-founded it with his wife, who I believe has been involved as well. But you know, this, I said he died of pancreatic cancer. I believe that was discovered and sort of progressed quite quickly. I know that he was still really active in that scene as recently as, like, you know, 5-6 months ago. So not a lot of time to sort of set up a long-term succession plan. And he was only 63. So it wasn't like he was, you know, necessarily about to retire in the next year or two. So that's something that we're going to have to follow. One thing I'll say is that, a lot of what he's done has been to kind of establish this as a destination and build up the infrastructure just in terms of people power and resources to attract those types of productions here. And certainly that's not going away. And the Hudson Valley at this point has obtained a little bit of a reputation, I think, as a good place to shoot movies. New York State passed that film and TV tax credit a couple of years ago that has made the state overall a more appealing place for film and TV productions to base their productions. So that's going to continue, certainly, but someone's going to have to pick up the torch from Laurent.
Yeah, and this full article about Laurent's passing and his impact on the Hudson Valley is up now at timesunion.com. It's by John W. Barry, and all the stories we've been talking about now are at timesunion.com. And we've been talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. Philip, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us tonight.
You got it. Take care. Always good to be with you.
Thank you. Well, that's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dolt. And I will not be back tomorrow night, unless I'm forgetting what day it is. Nope, it's Thursday. I will not be here tomorrow, but neither will Patricio Rubio. Kimberly Izar will be in, hosting the local edition tomorrow evening, taking you into your weekend. You don't want to miss that. You always want to be listening to Radio Catskill for our local news and conversation programs that come to you 5 days a week in the morning and the evening. Radio Catskill with Tim Bruno every weekday morning at 10. The local edition right here at 6. I mean, you never want to miss these shows, but you definitely don't want to miss these shows next week, because we're celebrating the annual anniversary of Woodstock, the Woodstock 1969 Woodstock Music and Arts Festival, which happened not far from here, nearby Bethel, New York. We've got a whole week of programming planned that we've been working very hard on here the last couple weeks, especially today. We had a team of reporters over at Bethel Woods investigating the camping situation now that Bethel Woods has regular camping on their site, not just on show nights, but also all the time over there during the season. So we're going to learn more about what the amenities are. They literally use the term embedded. They embedded me on an alumnus tour, meaning somebody who was originally at Woodstock, who shared their oral history with the Bethel Woods Woodstock History Project, came back to see the site for the first time since they were here in 1969. I was able to follow her and her family around with a microphone that whole day, and I'll be bringing you that report. We're going to speak to a Woodstock photographer and famed 1960s rock and roll photographer, Elliot Landy. And we have much more for you. So definitely don't miss what we've got for you next week. And the cool thing is next weekend, not this weekend, but next weekend is the Woodstock anniversary weekend. And it's one of those rare ones where the dates line up. So meaning, like, Woodstock was primarily, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, August 15th, 16th, 17th in 1969. Well, here in 2025, it's Friday the 15th, Saturday the 16th, and Sunday the 17th. So all the more reason to celebrate. And that's just part of the local news and culture that we bring to you, and history as well. So look forward to all of that coming up next week. But in the meantime, we've got a lot of great programming. We've got Claire with Ramble Tamble coming up at 7. But before that, there is more news from the Daily. This is Radio Catskill. Thank you so much for listening. Local news, culture, and NPR.
Support comes from the Wayne County Farmers Market. selling local produce, baked goods, and so much more. Saturdays 9:30 to 12:30 in front of Dave's Super Duper Supermarket, 200 Willow Avenue, Honesdale. More information on Facebook and PoconoMountains.com/Honesdale/events. And from The Cooperage Project, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org.